All right, we're diving into a Supreme Court case today.
Sounds exciting.
Well, it is, actually. This one's called Montana v. United States.
From 1981?
Yep, that's the one.
It might seem a little dry at first glance.
Like, oh no, not another old legal case?
Yeah, exactly. But believe me, this case is like the bedrock of modern tribal sovereignty law.
You sent us a whole bunch of stuff on this one.
You're really interested.
We are, and we know a lot of our listeners are too.
Well, get ready, because its effects are still rippling through legal battles even today.
It's wild how a case from decades ago can still be so relevant.
It all boils down to this really fundamental question.
Okay, hit me with it.
When you've got non-tribal members who own land within a reservation's boundaries.
Like these checkerboard reservations you always hear about.
Exactly, those.
So you've got this mix of tribal and non-tribal land ownership all jumbled up together.
It gets messy.
And then the big question is, who gets to call the shots on that land?
Especially when you're talking about things like hunting and fishing.
Which are huge issues, especially out west.
Absolutely.
So that's exactly what the Crow tribe in Montana was trying to figure out.
They were trying to regulate hunting and fishing on their reservation.
Makes sense. It's their land, right?
Well, that's how they saw it.
But there's a twist.
There's always a twist.
They were trying to regulate these activities not just on tribal land, but on land owned by non-tribal members, too.
And that's where things got complicated.
Because the state of Montana stepped in and said, not so fast.
They basically said, hold on, those activities are under our control.
So you've got the Crow tribe asserting their sovereignty.
And Montana pushing back, flexing its own authority.
Classic power struggle.
Oh, yeah. This is a classic case of two different entities claiming the right to make the rules.
And the Crow tribe, what were they basing their arguments on?
Treaties from way back in the 1800s.
Treaties, huh? Like historical agreements.
Exactly. 1851 and 1868, to be precise.
Wow, those are old.
They are.
And what did these treaties say?
Well, the Crow tribe argued that these treaties guaranteed them certain rights, including the right to regulate hunting and fishing on their reservation.
They saw it as their inherent right.
Exactly. They were saying, look, this is our land, these are our resources, and we have the right to manage them.
Seems pretty straightforward, right?
You would think so.
What was Montana's counterargument? How did they justify stepping in?
They pulled out this legal doctrine called the Equal Footing Doctrine.
Okay, the Equal Footing Doctrine.
That's kind of a mouthful.
It is. Break it down for us. What does it actually mean?
Essentially, it says that when a new state joins the union.
So like when Montana became a state.
Yep.
Okay, keep going.
They come in with the same rights as all the existing states.
Makes sense.
Including ownership of the land beneath what are called navigable waters.
Navigable waters. So like rivers you can sail on.
Exactly.
So Montana was basically saying, we own the riverbeds, even the ones that flow through reservations.
Yep, that was their argument.
So you've got these old treaties saying one thing, and this doctrine saying another.
A real legal showdown.
No wonder this ended up in the Supreme Court.
The highest court in the land had to step in and untangle this mess.
So who did they side with? The Crow tribe?
It's not quite that simple.
Of course not. This is the Supreme Court we're talking about.
They did side with Montana on the riverbed issue.
Really? What was their reasoning there?
They said that the language in the treaties wasn't clear enough to override the equal footing doctrine.
So Montana got to keep control of the riverbeds.
On that point, yes.
But this is where it gets really interesting, right?
Oh, yeah. This is where the case takes a turn.
Because this case wasn't just about riverbeds.
It had much broader implications for tribal sovereignty.
Tell me more.
The Supreme Court actually established what's now known as the Montana Test.
The Montana Test. That sounds important.
It is. It's kind of a big deal in Indian law.
Okay. I'm all ears. Break it down for me.
This test is used to determine when a tribe can actually regulate non-members on their land.
Even on land that's not technically owned by the tribe.
Exactly.
So what does this test actually look at?
It essentially says that tribes can't regulate non-members on non-tribal land within a reservation.
So there's a limitation on their authority.
Yes. But there are two important exceptions.
Two exceptions.
Two exceptions where the tribe can still exert some control.
Okay, this is getting juicy. Tell me more.
The first exception kicks in when there's a consensual relationship between the tribe and the non-member.
Consensual relationship, like they've agreed to something.
Exactly. Think about a business contract.
Where a non-tribal company is doing business on the reservation.
And they agree to operate under tribal rules.
So they're basically consenting to be bound by those rules.
Precisely.
Okay, that makes sense. What about the second exception?
This one's a little more complex.
Hit me with it.
It applies when the non-member's actions directly threaten the tribe's political integrity, economic security, or health and welfare.
So if a non-member is doing something that's really harming the tribe.
Exactly. And the court has to determine if that harm is significant enough to warrant tribal regulation.
I see. So it's not a complete denial of tribal authority?
No, not at all.
But it definitely sets up some very specific hoops for tribes to jump through.
It does, and there's been a lot of debate about whether those hoops are too high.
I bet. Were all the justices on board with this Montana test?
Actually,
no. There was some disagreement.
Oh, yeah.
Tell me about it.
One justice in particular, Justice Blackmun, along with a couple of others, dissented from part of the majority opinion.
What was his problem with it?
Well, he argued that treaties should be interpreted from the tribe's perspective.
What does that mean exactly?
He was saying we need to consider the tribe's understanding of the agreement.
At the time the treaty was made?
Yep. He was saying we can't just impose our modern interpretations on these historical agreements.
Makes sense. You got to look at the context.
Exactly.
Well, what did he think the outcome should have been?
He believed that taking the tribe's perspective into account would have led to a different outcome.
Possibly one that favored the Crow tribe's claim to the riverbed.
It's possible.
So even within the court itself, there were different views on how to interpret these complex legal issues.
And those different views have continued to shape legal debates about tribal sovereignty to this day.
Wow, this Blackmun dissent, did it have a lasting impact?
It absolutely did. It brought to light a really important point of contention in Indian law.
Which is?
Understanding treaties from the tribal perspective, it's a reminder that there are often multiple ways to interpret these agreements.
And that those different interpretations can have huge consequences.
Absolutely. This case is more than just a dusty old legal decision.
It's a living, breathing example of the ongoing struggle for tribal sovereignty here in the U.S.
And its legacy continues to shape legal battles and policy decisions even today.
Okay, I'm starting to see the bigger picture here.
This is about more than just hunting and fishing rights.
It's about fundamental questions of power and authority.
About who gets to make the rules and whose voices are heard.
And ultimately, about the future of tribal nations in the United States.
Exactly.
This has already given me a lot to think about.
I'm sure it is.
But I know a lot of our listeners were probably wondering, why should we care about a case from 1981? It seems like ancient history.
I get it. It might seem like a long time ago, but trust me, Montana v. United States is far from irrelevant.
It's not just a history lesson.
Nope. It's a case that has shaped the legal landscape for tribes across the country.
Give us some more context. Why is this case still so important today?
Well, because it highlights the much bigger issue of balancing tribal sovereignty with state and federal interests in the U.S. This case has had a ripple effect all across Indian country, shaping how tribes assert their authority and protect their resources.
Okay, I'm starting to see the bigger picture here. So this Montana test is kind of a double-edged sword.
You could say that.
It recognizes some tribal authority, but also puts pretty clear limits on it.
It does. It strikes a balance, but it's a balance that many people argue is unfair to tribes.
I bet it makes you wonder how this case has actually affected legal battles and tribal jurisdiction over the past four decades.
Well, since 1981, the Montana test has basically become the foundation of tribal jurisdiction law. It's been cited in hundreds of cases, showing just how big of an impact it's had. Cases involving everything from environmental regulations to business disputes on reservations have all been decided using this test.
I bet there are some pretty wild examples of how this case has played out in real-life situations.
Oh, absolutely.
Walk us through a few, if you would.
You got it. One area where Montana v. United States has had a huge impact is environmental law.
Like how tribes protect their natural resources.
Exactly. For example, there was this case involving the Navajo Nation and a coal-fired power plant operating on their reservation.
Wait, hold on. Before we get into that.
Oh, you're right.
Let's take a quick break. We'll come right back to hear more about how Montana v. United States has shaped the legal landscape.
So this case with the Navajo Nation and a coal-fired power plant.
Yeah, you were just getting to that.
This power plant, it was on their reservation.
Okay.
But owned by a non-tribal company.
Ah, I see where this is going.
And unfortunately,
it was causing problems.
It was polluting big time.
Air pollution, water pollution.
Both.
And that was affecting the tribe's health and environment.
Directly.
So the Navajo Nation obviously wasn't happy about this.
Not at all.
I bet they tried to use the Montana test to gain some control over the situation.
Exactly. They argued that this pollution, it was a direct threat to their health, their environment.
Which fits right under that second Montana exception.
Yep. The one we talked about earlier about threats to the tribe's well-being.
So this case shows how tribes have used the Montana test to try and protect their environmental interest.
And push back against harmful activities, absolutely.
So even though Montana v. United States limited tribal authority in some ways, it also gave them a legal tool to fight back.
It's a bit of a mixed bag, isn't it?
It is. A double-edged sword, as they say.
It's definitely not a perfect solution.
There's still debate about whether it goes far enough.
Oh, yeah. Plenty of debate about the limitations it places on tribal sovereignty.
But at least it's something.
It's a precedent, and tribes have been able to use it strategically.
That's good to hear.
It's not all doom and gloom.
Makes you wonder, though, what other areas have been affected by this case? We've talked about hunting, fishing, and environmental regulations.
There's a whole bunch more.
What else comes to mind?
Well, taxation.
Taxation.
That's a big one.
How so?
The ability of tribes to tax non-members who are doing business on their reservations.
Oh, interesting.
That's a really complicated issue, and the Montana test has had a major impact on the legal battles surrounding it.
Okay, now you've got me intrigued. How does the Montana test even apply to something like taxation?
Think of it this way. Imagine a non-tribal company sets up shop on a reservation right there.
Okay, got it.
They're there to sell goods or services, make a profit.
Makes sense.
The question is, can the tribe tax that company's business activities?
I see. It's not a simple yes or no answer.
Not at all.
So if that company had signed some kind of agreement with the tribe.
Like a lease agreement, for example.
Wouldn't that fall under the consensual relationship exception?
Bingo. That's a perfect example of the first Montana exception in action.
So the tribe could tax them in that case?
Potentially, yes, because that lease agreement means the company has basically said they're okay with being bound by certain tribal regulations.
Which could include taxes.
Right.
But what if there's no agreement like that? Can the tribe still tax the company?
That's where things get tricky. That's where the second exception comes into play.
The one about threats to the tribe's well-being?
You got it.
So the tribe would have to prove that the company's activities are actually harming them.
In a very specific way, yes.
Like how?
They'd have to demonstrate that the company's actions directly threaten the tribe's political integrity, economic security, or health and welfare.
That sounds like a pretty high bar to clear.
It can be, and there's a whole mountain of case law that has built up around this very issue.
Courts have been wrestling with this for years.
Decades, really, trying to figure out just how much economic impact there has to be, for example, to trigger that second exception.
I see. And how directly do the non-members' actions have to threaten the tribe?
Right. There's no easy answer. It can get incredibly complex.
So the Montana test, while it provides this framework, also leaves a lot of wiggle room for interpretation.
It does, and that highlights one of the ongoing challenges for tribes.
Which is?
They're constantly trying to navigate this incredibly intricate legal landscape, trying to assert their sovereignty.
Within all these constraints imposed by federal and state law.
Exactly. It's a tough spot to be in.
It makes it sound like this whole thing is just a never-ending legal battle.
In many ways it is, but tribes are resilient, they're creative.
They're fighters.
They are. They're constantly finding new ways to assert their rights.
So we've talked about the environment and taxes. Any other key areas where the Montana test has been a major factor?
Oh, tons. But one that really stands out is law enforcement.
Law enforcement.
Yeah, like can tribal police detain or arrest non-Indians on reservation lands?
That's a big question.
It is. It raises serious concerns about public safety and tribal sovereignty.
I bet. So what does the Montana test have to say about a tribe's ability to enforce its laws when non-members are involved?
It applies here, too. Generally, tribal police can only arrest or detain non-Indians if they've committed a crime that poses a direct threat to the tribe's political integrity, economic security, or health and welfare.
Wait, that sounds familiar.
Right. It's that second Montana exception again.
It's like it's following us everywhere we go in this case.
It's a core element of the test, but there are some nuances when it comes to law enforcement.
Like what?
Well, for example, in 1990.
Relatively recently.
Relatively, yeah. Congress amended Public Law 280.
Now remind me, what's Public Law 280 all about again?
It's this federal law, and it essentially gives states some criminal jurisdiction.
Over what?
Over certain offenses that happen on reservation land.
Okay, and what did this amendment do?
It clarified that tribal courts still have the inherent right to prosecute non-Indians who commit domestic violence crimes against Native victims within their territory.
So even though the Montana test generally limits tribal law enforcement over non-members, there are specific exceptions.
Especially when it comes to protecting Native women and families from violence.
That makes sense. It's about protecting the most vulnerable.
Exactly. And that amendment to Public Law 280 reflects this growing understanding of the need to protect Native victims, no matter who the perpetrator is.
So it sounds like the legal landscape surrounding tribal jurisdiction is constantly evolving.
It is. It's a complex and ever-changing area of law.
This whole conversation has really shed light on the complexities of federal Indian law.
It's a fascinating area, but also incredibly challenging.
Especially for tribes who are just trying to exercise their inherent right to govern themselves and protect their citizens?
Absolutely. It's a constant balancing act.
The Montana test, while imposing certain limitations, has also spurred some positive changes.
Like that amendment to Public Law 280, for instance.
Right. So it's not all bad.
No, not at all.
Okay. I want to shift gears a bit. We've been talking about the impact of Montana v. United States within the U.S. legal system.
Makes sense. It's a U.S. Supreme Court case, after all.
But I'm curious, how has this case been viewed internationally, especially in relation to indigenous rights?
That's a great question, and it's something legal scholars have been examining more and more.
What are they saying?
Well, the Montana test, with its focus on limitations to tribal sovereignty, it's actually raised some eyebrows internationally.
Really?
Some legal experts see it as an example of how domestic laws can sometimes fall short of fully recognizing indigenous rights.
So a landmark decision in the U.S. might be seen as problematic from a broader international perspective.
You could say that critics of the Montana test, they argue that it places too many restrictions on tribal sovereignty.
They say it doesn't go far enough.
Right, and that it fails to acknowledge the inherent right of indigenous nations to govern themselves.
I see. And what do they point to support that argument?
They often point to international agreements, like the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People.
UNDRIP.
Exactly, UNDRIP.
And what does UNDRIP say?
Well, it asserts the right of Indigenous people to give or withhold consent.
Consent to what?
To decisions that affect their lands, territories, and resources.
Which seems like a pretty fundamental right.
It is, and it's one that many people argue is not fully recognized by the Montana test.
So there's a disconnect between the framework established by Montana v. United States
and the principles of indigenous rights recognized internationally.
That's a great observation, and it's a point of ongoing debate.
It is, the Montana test, as a product of U.S. law.
It reflects U.S. legal traditions and history.
Right, and that has prompted discussions about whether it truly protects tribal sovereignty and aligns with these evolving international norms on indigenous rights.
That's something to think of. It seems like we're left with more questions than answers.
Often the case with complex legal issues.
It is. But this has been a really thought-provoking discussion so far. We've covered a lot of ground.
We have. Everything from the Montana test itself to its impact on environmental regulations, taxation, law enforcement.
And even international perspectives on indigenous rights.
It's a complex case with a long reach, that's for sure.
And it really underscores that often contentious relationship.
Oh, yeah, that's always there.
Between tribal sovereignty and state and federal interests here in the U.S.
A constant tension.
Well, you've given us a lot to think about, but before we get too overwhelmed,
take a deep breath.
Let's move on to part three, where we'll dive into some specific case studies that have been directly shaped by Montana v. United States. All right. Welcome back to the show. We're wrapping up our deep dive into Montana v. United States.
This case keeps on giving.
It does. In the last two segments, we really got into the nitty-gritty of the Montana test.
All those ins and outs.
Yeah, and we talked about how it affects all sorts of stuff.
Environmental regulations, law enforcement.
Taxation, even international perspectives on indigenous rights. It's a lot.
It is.
But I'm really eager to hear about those case studies you mentioned.
Oh, yeah. You want to see how this all plays out in the real world?
Exactly. Give us some real-world examples of how Montana v. United States has actually shaped legal battles.
You got it. One that really stands out is Street v. A1 Contractors.
Street v. A1 Contractors.
This one went all the way to the Supreme Court in 1997.
Okay, so pretty recent.
Relatively. Yeah.
And what was this case about?
It involved a car accident.
A car accident?
On a highway that ran right through the Crow Reservation.
Okay, car accidents, not exactly what I pictured when we started talking about hunting and fishing regulations.
It's true. This one takes us in a different direction.
So how did the Montana test even come into play in a situation like that?
Well, the accident involved two non-tribal members.
Okay.
But it happened within the reservation's boundaries.
So on the Crow Reservation.
Yep. And the question was,
did the tribe have jurisdiction?
Exactly. Did the Crow tribe have the authority to handle the lawsuit that came out of this accident?
God.
The Supreme Court, applying the Montana test.
Oh, here it is again.
It always comes back to this. They ultimately said no.
Wait, but it happened on their land. Why wouldn't they have jurisdiction?
It's tricky. See, the highway, it was built using right-of-way easements.
Easement.
These are agreements that give someone the right to use someone else's land for a specific purpose.
Okay, so the highway wasn't entirely on tribal land.
These easements, they were granted by the federal government, so the tribe didn't have the same level of control over that specific stretch of land as they would over other parts of the reservation.
So the specifics of land ownership really mattered in this case.
Absolutely crucial. That's one of the things the Montana test really gets into, those nitty-gritty details.
It does. Straight VA1 contractors. It really shows how the Montana test can lead to very specific rulings.
Very nuanced, depending on the exact circumstances.
It also highlights how those checkerboard patterns of land ownership.
Oh, yeah. Those are a nightmare.
They can create some real jurisdictional headaches on reservations.
They really do.
Okay, you've got me hooked. What other cases illustrate just how complicated this can get?
Here's one. It's a bit sensitive.
Okay, lay it on me.
Mississippi Band of Choctaw Indians v. Holyfield.
Mississippi Band of Choctaw Indians v. Holyfield.
That's the one.
What was this one about?
This case involved the tribe trying to regulate gaming activities on their reservation.
Gaming? Like casinos?
Exactly, but there's more.
There's always more.
It also involved the adoption of two children.
Adoption. Okay, now this is getting interesting.
These children, they were born to non-tribal members.
But on the reservation.
Right. But the adoptions, they actually took place off the reservation.
Off the reservation.
Yeah, but the tribe argued that they still had jurisdiction.
Even though the adoptions happened elsewhere?
Exactly. They were making a bold claim.
So how did the Montana test factor into an adoption case? It seems pretty far removed from hunting and fishing regulations.
The tribe argued that these adoptions, even though they happened off reservation, they still threatened their political integrity.
How so?
And their cultural continuity, they were worried about these children being raised outside of the tribe.
They were trying to protect their heritage, their identity.
Exactly. They claimed that this fell under that second Montana exception.
The one about threats to the tribe's well-being.
That's the one they were saying, look, this is about our future as a people.
That's a powerful argument.
It is. And the Supreme Court, they actually sided with the tribe.
Really?
They upheld the tribe's jurisdiction in this case.
Oh, that's a big win for the tribe.
It was. It's a really interesting example of how the Montana test, while it often limits tribal authority, can also be used to protect crucial tribal interests in certain situations.
It's a reminder that this test isn't just about black and white rules.
It's about trying to find that balance between tribal sovereignty and state interests.
A balance that is constantly being negotiated and reinterpreted.
Absolutely.
These cases are really fascinating. They're bringing the lasting impact of Montana v. United States to life.
It's not just about abstract legal principles.
It's about real people, real communities, real lives.
Exactly. And these are just two examples among hundreds.
There are so many cases out there that have been shaped by this decision.
Montana v. United States has been cited in legal decisions about everything from water rights to environmental protection.
Taxation, criminal jurisdiction, it's everywhere.
It is. And it shows how this decades-old decision is still shaping the relationship between tribes and the U.S. legal system today.
It sounds like this case, rather than being a dusty relic of the past,
which some people might think it
is actually a living, breathing precedent that's still being debated and interpreted in courtrooms across the country.
It's very much alive, that's for sure.
So where do we go from here? What does all of this mean for the future of tribal sovereignty?
That's the big question, isn't it? This tension, the one between tribal sovereignty and state and federal authority, it's been a constant throughout American history.
A constant struggle.
And the Montana test, it's a reflection of that ongoing struggle. It's a snapshot of where things stand, but it doesn't tell us where we're going.
It does feel like finding that balance, respecting tribal sovereignty while navigating the complexities of the U.S. legal system.
It's like walking a tightrope.
It's an ongoing challenge, that's for sure.
Tribes are constantly having to find creative ways to assert their inherent rights, to work within the boundaries of decisions like Montana v. United States, but also to push against those boundaries.
To make their voices heard.
Exactly.
So what are some of the strategies tribes are using to do that, to push back against those limits and strengthen their sovereignty?
Well, litigation is a big one. Tribes are actively going to court.
To challenge laws they see as unfair.
Challenging laws, challenging policies, anything they believe infringes on their rights.
So they're not just sitting back and accepting the status quo.
Oh, no, they're fighting back and they're also building coalitions.
With other tribes.
With other tribes, with advocacy groups. They're working together to make their voices louder, to have more impact, to push for laws that truly recognize and protect tribal sovereignty.
So it's a multi-pronged approach. Legal battles on one hand, political advocacy on the other.
You got it.
And there's one more thing we can't forget about.
Oh, yeah.
Economic development.
Right. That's crucial.
As tribes build stronger economies,
create more opportunities for their people,
they gain more independence, more power.
They increase their self-sufficiency, and that strengthens their ability to govern themselves effectively.
I'm hearing a theme here. Resilience, determination, a real commitment to shaping their own destinies.
It's inspiring, isn't it? Tribes have faced so many challenges.
So much adversity.
But they continue to demonstrate incredible resilience and unwavering dedication to protecting their cultures, their lands, and their right to self-government.
It's a powerful story.
It is, and it's a story that's still being written.
Well, this has been an incredible journey.
A deep dive, for sure.
We've explored the details of Montana v. United States, its far-reaching impacts.
And the ongoing fight for tribal sovereignty.
I feel like I've learned so much.
I hope so. It's a topic that deserves our attention, our continued exploration.
It's not always easy to talk about these things.
These are complex issues.
But they're important. And the legacy of Montana v. United States serves as a powerful reminder.
A reminder of what?
That the journey towards justice and recognition for tribal nations, it's far from over.
It's an ongoing journey, and we all have a role to play.
You've definitely given our listeners a lot to think about. So as we wrap up this deep dive,
time to come up for air.
I want to leave you with one final thought. How can we, as informed citizens, support tribal communities in their efforts to assert their sovereignty to build a better future?
That's the question we should all be asking ourselves.
Keep exploring, keep learning, and keep engaging with these crucial issues. Thanks for joining us.